So welcome again. Our next speaker is James Killigan. James Killigan is a political economist and the managing director of Economic Democracy Advocates. Since 1975, he has been an economic analyst for government agencies in more than 50 countries, as well as for many international organizations. He served as policy advisor and writer for several international leaders, including Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, French François Mitterrand, Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and he was also a member of the Willy Brandt Commission in the early 1980s. James Killigan is both an economist and an activist, and he writes about political economy of bioregionalism and about promoting ecological sustainability through participatory democracy management. As an activist, he is committed to advocate for legislation to ensure that both present and future generations have enough resources to meet their needs. We welcome him to Portugal, James Killigan.
Thank you. Bom dia. I'm really grateful to be here. This is quite a special event, I think, very significant. The topic of my presentation today is about organizing social and economic justice, but more fundamentally, it's about what is the next labor movement. And as we go through this, you'll begin to understand why I think that that's the key to social and economic justice. I was introduced as working for the Willy Brandt Commission. And the last time I was in Portugal was 40 years ago this month. And I was at a meeting launching the Brandt Commission report on North-South issues. And here's heads of state from Europe and Menachem Begin talking to Willy Brandt. The fellow in the middle on the left with a goofy smile is me at 29 years old, secretary for the Brandt Commission, doing publicity and as well as research for the Brandt Commission. So you remember Willy Brandt. As Chancellor of West Germany, possibly you remember, he was quite, and he created a commission on North-South issues. So what is North-South issues? The global North and the global South. And essentially, the idea was that the rich countries were in the global North and the poor countries were in the global South. And the rich needed to share more with the poor. So the report issued a lot of recommendations on how that was to work, including food and aid and sharing energy and sharing technology, and also reforming the international monetary system. So a lot of interesting things. And it's significant that it was in 1980, because when you think about it, that was kind of the beginning of neoliberalism. And in fact, the North-South report, with the dividing line there between the richer countries, and of course it's not really, because Australia is included in the North, but the idea was that the rich were in the North and the poor were in the South. And of course it's a gross abstraction. It doesn't, that's just a generalization. But it had something significant to it, because the basic premise was that developing countries were being exploited both for their labor and for their resources, natural resources. And so that's kind of significant. But for me at that particular period of my life, when I was really deciding what all this meant, working for this commission and rich and poor, I began to look at the North as kind of the management of the planet in 1980, and the South as being like the labor of the planet. So the traditional management labor kind of construct. And I also began to wonder, after watching developments at that time, exactly, this report was the most popular book on international development up until that time in history. It sold many, many copies across the world. It was very, very popular. And we had a chance to get this adopted in 1981 at the G7 summit. We failed because of enormous pushback from what we now know as neoliberalism. We didn't have a name for it then, but those were the forces at work then. So I would submit to you that neoliberalism is maybe something kind of strange and undefinable, but the way I've always looked at it, and the way we looked at it in the Brandt Commission, where we were trying to push back on the ideas from coming from right-wing economic policies, was this. And we kept going back to this chart because it's so prescient. So the Limits to Growth book that was published by the Club of Rome was developed by researchers in the United States along with the MIT computer scientist, Jay Forrester, who basically opened up the keys to a new era of development projection. In other words, using mainframe computers, which were very exotic at that point. We all have our personal computers now, but in those days, all you could get was these big mainframes. And this was the study that opened up economic analysis to a broader panorama than it had ever been really looked at before. So what they did is they took a look at the carrying capacity of the planet for through the 21st century. And they had different scenarios. If the government intervened in the economy, then it would look like this. If it didn't intervene in the economy, it would look like this. If we didn't regulate the drop in resources that was becoming evident in 1970, then it would go into a precipitous drop. And along with that would be food dropping in output, and as well as industrial output, and many other factors. This is just a very limited snapshot of what they said. And of course, at the same time, population would continue to grow. So a lot of people looked at this and said, well, this is a recipe for disaster. But a group of people looked at this and said, this is an opportunity to fulfill our agenda. And in fact, if you look at this between the period of 1970 and year 2000, roughly 30-year period, we had the development of the deregulation of the monetary system, the deregulation of the financial system of the world, and the deregulation of trade, all of which led to greater privatization. Okay, in a 30-year period, that's what we experienced. And since then, we've come into a period where neoliberalism has changed. It is something different now. We don't have a name for it, but I'll get into that shortly. But what I'm submitting to you here is that knowing that there was a drop in resources as early as the late 60s or 1970s, that is non-renewable resources. The availability of non-renewable resources we knew were going to go in decline because of these mainframe computer projections about the future of what the 21st century would look like. And as a result of that, some very thoughtful people began to develop these policies of deregulation and privatization. And the Brandt Commission continually pushed back against this, but ultimately we failed because we couldn't enter into the negotiation process because Ronald Reagan and Helmut Kohl and Margaret Thatcher had already come into office by the time we issued, or around the time that we issued our report. And we got a little bit of traction, and then it flopped because we saw the wind blowing in a different way, and we could not sustain the push to make things any different. But what we saw was this drop coming, and here we are. Look at 2020. Look where we're at right now. And we knew this 50 years ago. This report came out nearly 50 years ago. We knew this. And the right wing said, it's a bunch of garbage. That's just crazy talk. But some people in the right actually began to build the structure of neoliberalism across the world. So I say that because for me as a young economist, it made me start thinking about long cycles. And I began to read people like Toynbee and later Tainter and Turchin and Nefedov more recently, but also P.R. Sarkar, who said that all civilizations have long-term demographic, social, political cycles of expansion and decline. So we were in a wave of great increase, and now we're beginning to go on the other side of it. And that has a momentous significance on how we view the world. And if we don't have an explanation for why we're going down that area of decline, then it may lead us to a hard landing when we get to the bottom. So my view, and what I've been working on for the last 40 years, is to try to understand how to manage that decline much better than we have. And we're nowhere near understanding how to do that. P.R. Sarkar, who I mentioned, had a theory of cyclical change in the world, which included warriors, intellectuals, acquisitors, and laborers. And basically, he said in any given period, one of these classes are in the ascendance. So this is the way it looks like. There's a rule of warriors. This is talking about history, historic cycles. A rule of warriors, then intellectuals govern the civilization, and then it's acquisitors, and then it's laborers. And he traced this through history, and he said, this seems like a general cycle that humanity has gone through. I focused on the laborer because I knew that was extremely important from my work with the Brand Commission. I recognize that also that industrial labor doesn't describe what labor means today. And I started thinking about that. And in any case, warriors who defend the nation and keep the peace, intellectuals develop our ideas about the world, acquisitors manage the practical aspects of life in terms of the marketplace, and laborers do the routine work, planting and harvesting, collecting trash, other low-tech, low-skilled jobs. Each cycle ends with an exploitative period of human misery that leads to a spontaneous revolution and overthrow of the existing system. That was Sarkar's thought about that and how it all ends. Very disturbing. Particularly when I began to think about the fact that if we're leaving an era of acquisitors and entering an era of laborers, how is labor really defined right now? What does it mean? Because most of us still think of it as industrial labor, and it's not, and it's creating a lot of confusion, and it's creating an identity crisis among working people who don't know exactly what they stand for anymore. That's the question. How will labor be organized in the future? I think it's a very key question, because is the next historical era of workers going to be like slave workers, like feudal workers, or like the workers of industrial fascism? This is a scary thought. Ruled by autocratic production and distribution, and now with information technology for surveillance and social control, and also replacement of workers with robots and artificial intelligence. What are we looking at here? If you don't even have a job, how can you even consider yourself a laborer anymore? So I think we have a
a narrow window of opportunity if you're interested in organizing as a group of people who, in fact, are laborers. Anybody who works on the computer today and is creating value is working, but you're not getting anything in return for it. Generally speaking, because unless you're using the computer at work, if you're just using social media, you are creating value. And who's getting the rewards of it? Facebook and the other people who collect your data, and you use it to sell you products in return. So it's tricky, but there's a way in which we could consider ourselves as being digital laborers, and there's more, and I'll get to that. Again, I'm returning to this model because it's so important, because it precisely describes where we're at right now, from 50 years ago. And the reason why I find it really useful to use this graph again is because even though it was done 50 years ago, it is so accurate that many, many scholars across the decades have looked at this again and again and said, this is right on target. And it really is, truly is. But what I want to point out is the influence of this model on Europe. So when we're talking about the deregulation of money, it was in 1971 that the United States government took the world off the gold standard, and we moved from an era of fixed exchange rates to floating exchange rates. And think of it as the beginning of the easy credit, easy money. Credit cards proliferated. There was no restraints on debt creation, and so the banks and credit card companies were more than happy to lend you money as long as you would pay back in exorbitant interest payments. But the deregulation of the monetary system in the 1970s was the beginning of neoliberalism. So I date the beginning of neoliberalism to 1971, when the United States took the world off the gold standard. And then, as I mentioned, during the 1980s, it was expanded by the influence of corporations and banks and insurance companies who wanted to have a free flow of cash across the board. They didn't want to be hampered with regulations. They made it so that there were international agreements from the new political parties who were now promoting this new form of neoliberalism, agreements that would make it the free flow of finance across borders more possible. And many people remember that era, but it's very important to think back that that wasn't always the case. We didn't have that free-flowing finance. And then in 1994, the World Trade Organization was created to do the same kind of thing with trade, to deregulate tariffs and trade barriers across the world. All right, so in that 30-year period, things got locked down, and we're still experiencing the effects of it. One of them is the euro, the creation of the European Union in general, but the euro especially, because it had a significance. The people of Europe were promised their four freedoms: goods, capital, services, and labor. I'm just going to talk today about the last part. There's a lot to be said about the first three, but the focus here is on labor. As we know, labor mobility became prevalent during this period. And at first, during European Union enlargement, it was the migration from the Central and Eastern European countries that were coming to the Northwest European countries at a significant rate. But it didn't cause that much disruption in the Northwestern European countries, because there's already a labor shortage there that would absorb the new workers coming in. But things changed a lot with the recession of 2007 to 2010, 2011. The free movement of labor before 2009 meant that there were economically dynamic cities and regions, particularly in North and Western Europe, and significant in-migration of skilled and semi-skilled workers to those areas. But as you know, in other places in southern and eastern Europe, the free movement of labor since 2009 has meant persistent out-migration, population decline, wealth and income inequality, unequal access to essential goods such as education and healthcare, and a brain drain of people with skilled labor and intellectual acuity moving out of those particular areas. And this is what it looked like, and you're familiar with this map, I'm sure. This is where the people in the red areas moved out and moved into the other areas. And it was all about labor mobility. So it was one of the EU's four freedoms. Okay, but what does that mean? Is it really freedom? Freedom to move is very important, but when it's driven by the necessity of finding a job somewhere else, yeah, that's a freedom, but it's not necessarily a freedom that you would think of as defining in terms of freedom. But what I'm getting at is that this is the bill of goods that the European Union sold to the people of Europe. Not having any popular buy-in for this regime, a regime that was created as a result of the deregulatory policies that were foisted by the banks and corporations in alliance with governments upon the people of Europe. Without that much, on the few occasions when people have tried to ratify the constitutional aspects of the European Union, it's been voted down. And so they've stopped trying to have those votes anymore because they know what the basic sentiment of people is. And when I'm talking about that, then I get back to the people who have failed to experience the upward educational and income mobility and felt abused and unrepresented by the EU. A lot of those people moved toward the right-wing parties, as you're experiencing now, opposing labor from Africa and the Middle East, and joining this new populist wave, which in general is cynical about the European Union, although appreciating many of its benefits, but at the same time, understanding that the European Union is brittle, and it needs to have a different kind of flavor to it. So what I'm suggesting to you is that there are two camps from the populist area who are looking at this. Those on the right who are very negative about the European Union, those on the left who are negative about the European Union, but they have very different attitudes about what it is that's wrong with the European Union and what the solutions are. So this goes back to, for me, as an observer of this for decades now, about the changing role of labor and putting that into perspective to see where we stand on all of this today. Because, you know, if labor is a productive activity that's specific to every historical period in society. And that's important to realize because long before industry and computers, people were predominantly farmers working the soil. And moving to the factories and mechanical development, and now we're in a new era of cybernetics and immaterial labor. So we were workers in every area, but what I'm suggesting to you is we don't really have an identity for this third area that we're in right now because we still think of ourselves as industrial workers. The problem is when labor is freely bought and sold on the market, labor power becomes a commodity with a value just like other commodities based on the cost of their production. So laborers are the same as, they're worth the same as apples or televisions or whatever. In other words, that in a fungible world, meaning all value is relative, then labor has a cost, this is for businesses. Labor has its own cost, how much do we pay our workers, how much do we charge for apples and how much do we charge for televisions. So that creates a real schizophrenia in the minds of workers because labor power as a commodity has led to massive problems in trade unions where there's corruption involved oftentimes. Certainly the mixed messages that public education has developed around why they do what they do, how they work. All public institutions have the same kind of split identity. And having worked in Europe for a long time, I recognize it, and it would only explain it this way, that when the choice was made whether to go communist or free market at first, Europe took the middle road, and of course, one of the fruits of that was social democracy. And I know it well, having worked for a lot of social democrats. The problem is this, that it creates a division of labor, an attitude toward non-waged work, and it's resulted in this new social economy that we have, including Uber and Lyft, people who are net slaves, people who are working in 24/7 electronic sweatshops. What I'm getting to is what I mentioned before, that we are doing a lot of work, but we're not getting paid for it. And this is a problem because we have our labor power is seen as a commodity. And if we can drive the value of that commodity as low as possible, then somebody's benefiting from it, but it's not people who are working. So the evolution of frameworks for the organization of labor has gone from, in the past, individualized artisan labor. Think of craft guilds and unions, the early forms of unions that were famous in the Middle Ages, for example. And then labor under state command, or at least state regulation, where the state said, okay, we'll allow you to organize under these limited conditions. And then labor power as a commodity. So what I'm getting at is labor has a very serious identity problem because labor has neglected its role in the right distribution of resources. There's nothing wrong, in fact it's right, to argue for basic minimum requirements of human beings, including adequate wages and earnings and higher standards of living, but that's not system change. The core issue is not raising the standard wage or the minimum standard of living, it's about transforming the structure of wage labor and rewarding economies of unpaid and invisible work, including caring and nurturing and maternal housework to digital labor and open source technology. All of those are undervalued. The new value of resources and labor comes down to this principle. When the elite classes fail to provide an accurate measure of the resources available within a region to meet the needs of the people who live there, then workers have to develop and utilize their own system of metrics for the production and distribution of resources. It's the distribution of resources that we're neglecting. We know that labor is associated with production, but we always forget about distribution, and I'll explain why. System change requires a new measure, unlike the GDP. Beyond the wage-labor measure of value is the broader conception of human work as an indicator of social metabolism, which is very much tied in with the happiness of economic happiness. Personal metabolism, we know what that is. We eat to work, and then we work to eat. It's a circular process. Our bodies need to consume energy, and in turn, our bodies burn this energy through physical and mental labor to create things of value. And just as the body depends for its vitality upon circulation of blood, the social metabolism can only be understood in terms of the circulatory process. Social metabolism essentially is the idea of society as an ecosystem, a cooperative commons of human labor. Cooperation, when you think about it, is collaboration, and the meaning of collaboration is labor, mutual labor, working towards self-governance and self-sufficiency for all people. Labor is a commons where the resources that are available meet the needs of people within that particular region. And that's a form of distributed. The old story was supply meets demand, labor is a commodity. The new story is labor as distributed value that's equal, voluntary, democratic, decentralized, self-organized, consciously planned. It satisfies people's needs. It uses scientific technologies. It shares knowledge and power. It has sufficient scale to mobilize. It recognizes interconnection with other people. It freely develops people's productive forces, and it satisfies our intellectual, artistic, and spiritual aspirations. Rational distribution across occupational national boundaries means organizing and combining effective workers, knowledge work, digital work, social work, cultural work, political work, ecological work, and spiritual work. Sadhvipras are leaders of a new labor movement, enlightened moralists with selfless virtues, who apply their energy to reappropriate the products of ecology and labor through democratic decision-making and create a new socially driven form of cooperatives through distributed value. Distributed value is the key here. Not productive value, but the distributed value that we get by meeting the needs of everybody. That's social and economic democracy today and tomorrow in Europe, if we organize to make it happen. Thank you very much.